At the end of the day, making free content doesn't come cheap. Show your support for the independent content you're listening to right now at patreon.com/8bitlife. That's patreon.com/8bitlife. Fine edition of my so-called 8-bit life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Now, we're going to try some new things today because truly this is an episode of mood for sure. First and foremost, at the top of the show, you guys should have probably heard the awesome, epic theme song made by Chalkboards for this show here. I had talked with Jacob before, had him on the show and the band, everything else like that, but I had actually asked them to make a theme song for me, and holy crap, did it turn out epic and awesome and glorious, and I think it's probably the best thing I've ever had for this show. So if you guys want to make sure to give some props where props is due, hit them up on Twitter at Chalkboards Band and let them know what you think. And also check out their Bandcamp. I think it's chalkboards.bandcamp.com, and give them a couple of bucks because they deserve nothing more than awesome. But the other thing I'm going to try out is actually kind of introduce who our guest is, and honestly, I think she does need a little bit of introduction. This week, I'm actually talking with Jenny Josephson. She's actually the producer for Daily Tech News Show. Some of you guys may listen to it. It's a show done by Tom Merritt in terms of the Daily Tech News and things like that. But what's really fascinating about this whole thing isn't so much that you know what she is, but it's more importantly where she came from and how she got where she is now, because ultimately, it's kind of the reverse for some people. In other words, people think of where she started was the pinnacle and that she should have stopped right then and there and stayed there. But through kind of this weird happenstance and sort of following her own sort of passion and her own sort of dreams and sort of a little bit about what she is as a person, she is exactly where she needs to be. So without further ado, here's the episode. Welcome to a fine edition of my so-called 8-bit life. I'm your host, Roberto Villegas. Joining me today, the producer of the Daily Tech News Show podcast, Jenny Josephson.
Well done.
I passed my podcaster test. I could finally apply for like the big leagues, because I think that's, you only get like 5 fails, I think, when you're like a professional or something like that.
It's 10.
Is it 10?
Yeah.
Okay, here's a question. How many times have you mispronounced a person's name on the air and felt utterly embarrassed? Or you can take the other side of that question. What's the worst one you remember?
Oh, well, all right. So I have done very little on camera or on mic work in my life, right? Okay. I was always behind the scenes. That is worse, because that means that I have written something into a rundown and it is patently incorrect and someone has said it on the airwaves or the stream or whatever it was. So I'm trying to think. I'll give you a simple one,
okay,
which is I sometimes build the Daily Tech News Show rundown the night before. So I have been known, before I literally set like a bear trap alarm on this, to write the day before into the rundown. And then, so say like it's Tuesday, May. Okay, where was it?
Telling your story. I'm sorry. I'm only because I hate. I'm a big fan of breaking the fourth wall. People, you probably didn't hear. You probably heard me laughing right then and there. Jenny had to go take care of something awesome, and if my editor Daryl does his job right, you'll hear it at the very end of the podcast.
It's one of those things that, like, nobody has knocked on our door all day, and I'm in the office, so nobody should be knocking on that door, and yet it happened right as we were taping, which is just tremendous.
This is actually, I quite enjoy those kind of those kind of distractions. Not those distractions, yes. I guess those interruptions, because they're just being such like the funniest one I think I've ever had. And I'll put this note and we'll ask you back to the details thing. I think I was doing a live taping with Brian, and we're at his house, and his daughter knocks on the door and walks in and proceeds to talk about this bird that like died in the yard or something like that. And it was so adorable because the tapes were, everything was rolling. And I'm like, we're not editing this out. This is way too funny. I'm going to keep this in here.
Well, all right. So back to, let's see, very simply, I've made Tom tell people, like 22,000 people, that it was the wrong day more than once, especially when like the calendar is involved, because the calendar's a day ahead. It's just like it's the joy and the specific detail of building a daily rundown. And I've been involved in daily news shows, but never at the rundown level, because I come from a world where all the jobs that are done by like one person or maybe two people in podcasting are done by 30 to 50 people. And so the idea of like becoming the one person responsible for building the basics of the lineup and then having Tom come in and be the one person who's responsible for the headlines and actually all the real editorial information in the show has been a huge, amazing learning curve for me. So that's like... it's just unbelievable.
That's what's funny for me, because I have been so entrenched in the world of podcasting, and it's what I tell a lot of people when they're starting to get, you know, starting out, and even as they're continue going on, is that a lot of the times, like, people are like, well, what do you do? Do you do this? Who do you get to do this? I go, well, I kind of do everything to get, you know, an all-in-one sort of, you know, go. And I think a lot of people just don't quite understand how small a team like podcasting is, because like, okay, because you're mentioning it, like in other productions it'd be 30 to 40 people. Like, what have you done before all this podcasting? You mentioned you're kind of off the mic, so to speak, off the recording, I should say, that your background is more in radio.
Well, okay, so when I say my background is radio, I mean that literally I was born into a radio family. My parents met at a Pacifica radio station out in Berkeley, KPFA, where my dad was on the air. And then they moved back to New York, and my dad was on the air in the 60s in New York in WBAI, and he and a bunch of people, including Bob Fass, who was like the night guy, helped sort of propel this idea of freeform radio forward, you know, because before then, radio had been very, like, very controlled, DJ, doing this, hey, here's the thing, it's like very programmed FM radio. And WBAI and the Pacifica stations were really responsible for breaking that mold. And so my dad was like one of the very first grumpy morning guys. He would show up late to air. This is not podcasting. This is like live FCC mandated air. He would eat right on the air. He would yell at the callers. He would hang up on them. And like he and specifically this guy, Bob Fass, who was on the Midnight Show, and another gentleman named Steve Post, along with a lot of other WBAI folks, were really responsible for breaking into this new form of freeform radio. So, like, every time I hear all the podcasters doing such amazing freeform live work, I think, you know, all this has happened before and all this will happen again.
I understand. Well, because it's... Go on, sorry.
Oh, so... So after that, like, that was me growing up. So, like, I used to have all these crazy experiences where, like, my dad and Garrison Keillor would share a cab ride home from the radio station when Garrison was in New York. And I'd be in the middle of the cab listening to them go back and forth, like, literally over my head. it was a fascinating growing up. But I then ran, you know, away from that. I didn't do any radio. And I ended up, you know, taking journalism courses and going into news radio for a year and then into television. So I have started my career at CBS News. So I did CBS News Radio as what they call the desk assistant. I was on the foreign desk at CBS News in television on the assignment desk. And then I got to be an associate producer out in our LA bureau, in CBS's LA bureau. So yeah, so I had this weird experience of like starting at the network level where there's like a person for every single job. And then that wasn't for me. Like it just felt like too Well, I could like spend a half hour telling you why like that wasn't quite the right job for
me. This is the funny thing is, you know, in especially in an interview show like this, and in the kind of way that life works, these are the kind of things I like to know about, because like I find it so fascinating, the idea of like you go from like, you know, if people would go, especially when it comes to podcasters or people that, you know, look at certain rankings of medias, television's always held in the highest regard, then below that is radio, then below that is the dregs of podcasting that I tend to really, really love and enjoy. But yet you went from that, like the pinnacle tier, the network TV, what people go and say, oh my God, you're on network TV. Everybody, you know, everyone sees what you do. You may not necessarily be on camera per se, but everyone is seeing what you do. Your name is in the credits. Everything's there. What made you leave all that then?
So I had maybe the best and most charmed run at, I mean, I really like nothing about my life has been unlucky in the job sense. And I loved so many of the people that I worked with at CBS News, but it came to me to in a very clear way that I was not a hardcore investigative journalist, and I would never be, because I didn't want to bug people. It was literally as simple as that. I did it. I went. I knocked on doors. I aggressively booked people. I waded through rubble in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in Biloxi, not in New Orleans, which is a whole different can of worms.
Right.
We covered Spatial when the Spatial Columbia blew up. I covered 6 months of the Michael Jackson trial. Like, I did it all. But I started to realize, like, there was just a thing missing in me. I did not want to find out all the information. I did not want to pester people and develop sources and bug people. And at the time, I would just describe myself as too soft. And also, I had a question, which was like, I used to do pieces for the Weekend News, which is a wonderful broadcast, and they do a lot of great features. And I found out that, like, I was unsatisfied. I'd do a piece, I'd, like, sweat through it, I'd agonize about it. It would go on the air, and then it would just go away. And that was all we ever saw of it. And, like, there was no, this was like a little pre-Twitter, you know, this was not, the social media age hadn't really taken off. And I just felt like, I wasn't sure if I wanted to make my entire career path about trying to do something that other people were better at in a medium where once it was on the air, it was just like on its way to Mars. So I wish I could tell you that I was thoughtful about it, but basically I came to this conclusion, I guess it was like in the middle of 2006, and I was miserable, and everybody in the bureau, my LA bureau, tried so hard to help me like choose the right path. And eventually, I was such a CBS baby that they had to can me to get me out of there, because I had already told them I don't want to stay the AP and I don't want to be the Weekend News producer. They were like, well, you only leave us one option. So that was the first boss who fired me that I hugged, because really, it was like the best for all of us. And then, yeah, seriously.
I love how you say that was the first boss that fired me that I hugged, implying that there's a second and or a third. And I'm gonna let you finish the story.
Yeah,
but you've left it open right there.
So after that, one of the things that I was sad about with the impending, like, doing the Weekend News was that there wouldn't necessarily be as much travel. And I loved doing the field work. That was the one thing I genuinely loved about working as an associate producer, which was you went all these amazing places and you worked with amazing people and you interviewed amazing people. So I was lucky enough at the time that Dan Rather Reports had just about started up, a couple months before I left CBS. And there were a lot of CBS people there, and one of them asked, said, you should go talk to the executive producer. And I did. And literally 2 weeks later, I found myself like 6,000 feet up Mount Hood in a snowcat doing a piece about these missing hikers. And I literally was like the happiest camper in the whole world, because I was back out in the field. I had a really wonderful producer I worked with named Sally Garner, who... Like, there's one thing that CBS news producers who, like, grow up in CBS, the real hardcore ones, they know how to do. They know how to think big, right?
Right.
So, like, for most of your life, you're going to be doing pieces about the news of the day or whatever's going on, you know, in your neighborhood or whatever it is. No, Sally decides she's going to pitch Dan Rather going to interview the Dalai Lama in India. And damn it, if she didn't go make it happen. And I was lucky enough to tag along as the associate producer on that piece. So in my repertoire of things that I will never forget that I got to do was to walk into the Dalai Lama's temple with Dan Rather and sit down and like do an interview, you know, have Dan do an interview with him. And it was about a cool topic too. It wasn't just like the Dalai Lama's history and experience. Like we did that hour, but we also did a piece about the science of neuroplasticity, which is like how to train your brain, how your brain evolves even, you know, past your childhood. And the Dalai Lama has supplied a lot of his monks to this scientific effort because guess what? They have tremendous control over what their brain does because they're such good meditators.
Right.
So if you're talking about like the highlight of my post-CBS career, that was it.
That's fucking insane. That is fucking – wait. Okay, because I had known that you – like I was thinking before, usually when I get a guest, I go, well, how am I going to meet them? How did I get wise to them? Whatever happened. And I remember like the first time we met was actually at South by So Wasted. Like you were there with South by So Wasted, for the people who have no idea, is an event thrown by the two hosts of Night Attack every South by Southwest, sort of a – a kind of semi-private, semi-open, sort of a weird kind of gathering of people at whatever bar we tend to have booked. And this year, both Tom Merritt came and his producer, Jenny, here. And I think our like first conversation was – I think it was essentially someone had asked me to explain the podcasting world in Star Trek terms or some weird thing like that.
Yes, that was me. Because I was still like trying to find my way because so I'd had all like these experiences.
Well, yeah,
because
you had like you'd already been at the fucking pinnacle of like I worked on associate producer of the Dalai Lama and here I am with the boys of like, you know, doodle deedle doo kind of stuff. Like I never would have thought I would hear the story of like my greatest moment in my journalistic career, quote unquote, was kind of being associate producer for an interview with the Dalai Lama. Like, you son of what the you know, like right, here I am just like humbling now.
But this is like halfway of the journey, right?
Right, right.
So I do that, and I've done some other work in this time period, and then eventually I fall into working at a place that I had previously only made fun of my husband for having a Yahoo email. I was like, Yahoo, you gotta get Gmail, and you're so behind the hot times. And then somehow I ended up working for Yahoo as a video producer, and I was like, how is it that my husband's out-of-date email does videos? And this is the first lesson, which is that, A, yes, Yahoo does videos, and B, in the time that I was there, and still to some extent today, they do tremendous videos.
No, yes. Yahoo's has, like, over the years, have figured out how to do things
like,
on a crazy
they have
level.
This production team, which I, you know, people don't give this team enough credit, but, like, I walked in there in October of 2010, and they had absolutely the most sophisticated, talented audiovisual production team that I have ever met almost anywhere. And these guys, like, they had the most incredibly sophisticated audio board I'd ever seen because a lot of their early videos were music. They knew how to, like, send you anywhere you wanted to go that, like, you could, if you were doing, like, a story about wilderness survival, like, they'd get you to, well, you know, West Virginia. Or if you were doing something overseas, they'd get you overseas. Like, I cannot overstate how fabulous these people were. And, like, there was definitely a let's just try it. And that had a lot to do with the person who was running Yahoo Studios at the time, whose name is Anna Robertson. She still does. And she was just one of those people that also was able to think big. And I think that is such a powerful skill, is the ability to, like, let's have a big plan and let's go execute it.
No, for sure. Totally. You mentioned earlier that Yahoo at the time was, let's just try anything. Was that the difference in your mind between, like, radio and television? Like, did you feel at the time, not because you didn't do anything big, I mean, Dalai Lama is huge as all hell, but you mentioned the idea that Yahoo is just like, let's try this, let's do this, let's give this a shot.
Absolutely. Because here's the thing, like, I was the negative part about starting at what would be considered theoretically the top of the broadcast pinnacle.
Right.
Is that you're doing one tiny thing and you might get good at that one tiny thing, but there's this entire ecosystem of things you don't know. And so, like, I was very insecure about writing for broadcast when I worked at CBS News because, you know, I was working with legends. I was working with legends.
Yeah.
Like, I once had to call why am I forgetting? I had to once call Mike Wallace.
Are you serious?
Because I wanted to use a video clip of his from a show that was so pre everything on television that he retained the rights to it. And I wanted to use it for a weekend news piece. It was about Frank Lloyd Wright. And of course,
right.
Mike Wallace had interviewed Frank Lloyd Wright. So I had to call and his assistant got him on the phone. And he was like, I was like, hi, Mr. Wallace, we really want to use this video, but we don't have a big budget. And so I was wondering, he was like, why would I give it to you for free? Okay, I'm sorry for having bothered you. So, like, you know.
That's amazing. I love the idea of just you like, hi, Mr. Wallace, I'm a really big fan. Yeah. We're doing this new segment. I mean, it's only cool if you want to give us the video.
It was so terrifying. And, like, you know, Andy Rooney used to, like, I used to do the overnight shift at CBS doing the international news. And, like, Andy Rooney used to, like, wander into the newsroom and, like, steal the newspapers, like, 'cause he wanted more newspapers. Like, it was a tip, but you, like, so you could see how I was, like, justifiably intimidated about my, like, barely there broadcast writing skills. So I get to Yahoo, and there's no structure. There's no, like, nobody's vetting your work. There's no geniuses of writing there. And so you just, you realize that maybe you had it in nascent form by just being around all these genius broadcast writers all these years. And I just put it together because nobody was paying attention.
Right.
And so we did this wonderful show called Weekend Edition, where we got to travel all over the country and interview amazing people and put together these little sort of 3 to 5 minute feature pieces. And then I did a couple of, like the great thing about Yahoo was, like, okay, so I'd be on this sort of, like, feature piece, and then they'd put me on a cooking show, which, okay, I did not know how to do a cooking show, you know, or then we did a piece about successful women. And then every once in a while, there'd come along, like, just a random project where, for example, we partnered with the 9/11 Memorial and Museum to do a series of pieces about the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and we just came up with the idea. These two amazing directors of photography that I worked with came, like, up with the format for just telling simple documentary style stories about what it was like 10 years after for both survivors of 9/11 and the families of those that had been lost. And there's a piece I did that I think I literally left a reasonable sized chunk of my soul in, because we were just given permission to go and make the best videos that we could make. And these guys were so responsible for, like, the look and the feel and these videos. And, like, that's hands down probably the – you want to talk about, like, the coolest thing. Yeah, sure, I went to go interview the Dalai Lama, blah, blah, blah. But you want to know the best thing I have ever done and probably ever will do is go interview the family of a guy who was lost in 9/11 – and how they honor him through baseball.
Okay, like, you got to explain the story now.
Okay, so, excuse me. So, one of the many people who were lost in the 9/11 attacks was this kid, he's 23 years old. His name was Kevin Williams. And he grew up on Long Island. He has this great family. They were sports, they loved all sports, but especially baseball, right?
Right.
And so when Kevin died, and, it was just as tragic as every other 9/11 story, which is to say the most tragic thing you've ever heard, his family decided that they wanted to honor his memory through baseball. And so they send kids to baseball camp who would otherwise not be able to go. And, it's hard to explain because it's just such a simple story, but it was a story about how do you fill the hole in your life when somebody like that, who really just seemed to be, like, the greatest kid on earth, and this idea that 10 years later, like, this family was just as shattered as they had been.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, like, and I've thought about this, especially with, I mean, in recent times with everything kind of in the news in terms of what's happened in, where is the college?
Santa Barbara.
Thank you, Santa Barbara. And, you know, at that point in time, and no matter what, and I, like, I can say from personal experience, not because I've necessarily lost a brother or anything like that, but about when I was, let's say I was in middle school, I ended up, one of my cousins actually died in a plane crash, my cousin Abby, about, maybe it was a little older than me, maybe about 2-3 years tops. I forget, to be honest, how old he is, but to this day, my aunt and uncle still, like, have pictures of him around there. You know, it is still a very, very fresh memory in the mind. So when you mention the whole story of just, you know, that they're still heartbroken, yeah, of course. It's almost near impossible to recover from losing a kid, especially at that age, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's just such a hard thing that it's so hard for us who have not experienced it to understand. And that was what, to me, was so powerful about all these stories that we told, was trying to just convey that very human loss once all of the politics and the, you know, the lawsuits and the, you know, the trials had become normal news. You were still left with these families. And, you know, so that's probably, honest to God, that's the proudest thing I am of anything I've ever done. And, you know, they were beautiful, and I hope that I get to do something like that again. But if I don't, at least I did that.
No, that is spectacular. Now, at the beginning of all this, and obviously we're eventually going to have to get beyond Yahoo and everything else, you had mentioned that there was a second time you had hugged a boss after they fired you.
So I was doing, like, my dream job at Yahoo.
Right.
And then what's the best way to put this? I needed... there were a lot of things that, as just a video producer, I wasn't getting the answers to. Like, why does a piece do well versus not do well? How do I get my piece on a page where it gets seen by the audience? Like, what do I do? And
the age-old question, how do you gain exposure?
How do you promote within Yahoo's own network?
Yeah.
And there only ever seemed to be one person with the answer to all those questions, so I went to go work for her.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So I left production, and I became sort of it was sort of like getting an MBA in the internet. And I did that for a year and a half, and it was really good, but it wasn't creative, and it wasn't what I was sort of like put on the earth to do. It was incredibly valuable, and I worked with good people, and I think I did a reasonable job. But if there was like a 5-person team and you had to shoot one of them in the head, it would have been me. So that's sort of what ended up happening. That's actually a terrible analogy to use.
Well, no, it at least explains, like, kind of that,
and so,
you know.
I think I even at one point told my boss, I was like, look, if things ever happen, it's me. It's me. Because like... And so one day they, you know, like, put me in an office and with my boss, and there was like an HR lady on the phone, and then I was out the door. But, you know, that was the second boss I hugged and basically said, hey, this is all going to be all right. And then oddly enough, about 2 months before I'd lost my job at Yahoo, I'd had a meeting with some guy that my friend Molly put me in touch with. And this guy and I met at Clementine Bakery in West LA. And we both kind of sat there and we're both like, yeah, we don't know about I don't know what's going on with our jobs. Things seem kind of up in the air. We both had sort of this weird... Like, we both walked away from this lunch being like, well, that person was cool, but I sounded like a jerk.
Okay, there has got to be – okay, for those people who were way in the dark, that person obviously is Tom Eric. There has got to be more to the story. You have left out, like – you have put in like, key pieces, like, my friend Molly Wood, told me about this guy, Tom Merritt, who just left his job – you know, ended contract at Twit. Like, there are pieces that you are just you have glossed. Like that is the key definition of glossing over details.
So this is one of those things where, you know, the people you meet, you never know how they're going to affect your life, right?
Right.
So let's skip back a little bit to, it was like 2010, and I was just freelancing all over the place, and I got hired to work for CNET. and or even CBS Interactive. It wasn't technically CNET. And so there was a woman named Claire who was doing these half-hour shows for all the CBS TV affiliates that were technology-related. And she had two hosts. And one was a really nice guy named Derek Shore, who I was paired with. And one was this, like, tall Amazon named Molly Wood. And someone else got her. Except that I was like, I immediately pegged her as, like, my future best friend of all time. Like, within 5 minutes. And we just started talking about Battlestar Galactica, I think, at the time. And Molly was like, no, her. And so we swapped producers, and I became Molly's producer. And we ran around Comic-Con for 2 days having, like, the best ever time. And so Molly became the one person that I always wanted to work with, but she was in San Francisco and I was in LA, and we were never going to really work together because, like, how were you going to do that?
Right.
But we just kept talking and talking, and you know, she would send me on, like, a thing, or I would go talk to someone that she wanted me to talk to, or I would send her to someone. And, like, you know, then she sent me to Tom, and she was like, you guys are in LA together. You should meet. And so we did in October. And then, oddly enough, on the same day I lost my job, which was, I think, December 5th, someone else ended their job.
And for those of you who have no idea, we've had Tom on the show prior to all this. Around that time is when, you know, for lack of better words, Twit ended the contract for Tom Merritt. And then he was sort of, I guess he's like, it's weird for me to say it, but I guess it's the only term I have. He was a free agent. And that sounds so weird to put that in, like, he was a free agent, like as if there's a podcasting draft going around and, like, we're all just free agents getting, you know, gobbled up by other teams, and to be, you know, to now extend an analogy that I can't even do.
He became independent.
That's
just what I love, because it was the same as me. Like, we had both been training all our lives in various fields in different ways, and we both achieved independence on the exact same day.
So that's why I just found it so freaking crazy when it was told that whole story. Now, okay, I have to ask before, because you kind of mentioned that, you know, we're kind of jumping back a little bit back to Yahoo, because mm-hmm. we're going to jump squarely into podcasting very, very soon. But you had mentioned that you couldn't quite understand how to promote things within the Yahoo network. What knowledge did you gain when you kind of shifted to that? Like, did you figure out the formula to promote stuff? Because I've noticed that, yeah, Tom Merritt has a certain following and everything else. But, I mean, if I compare what Tom was doing at you know, Tech TV to then CNET to then TNT and Twit to now, like, now is light years. Like right. It's still the same content, but I mean, we have a man that is, although we're not quite at the number he wants to quite be at, which is great, who's technically getting paid $10,000 a month for just amazing. Doing podcasting, you know.
Amazing. So the answer is, here's what I learned at Yahoo. And the answer that I learned at Yahoo will be different for every other organization.
But of course.
It is know thy audience. Right? So Yahoo knew their audience very well, because they had 10 years worth of data plus, you know, and they knew enough about their signed in audience, and they had a ton of data on what their audience liked, what they didn't like. So in the grand old days, they could tell you exactly what a piece was going to do, or how it was going to do, or whatever it was going to do, because they knew what had come before. And that's what I loved about the internet, was you didn't have to rely on Nielsen's or statistical analysis of Nielsen boxes. Like, there were tracking pixels, and as long as those tracking pixels were correctly deployed, they would tell you how many people watched your stuff. You could read in the comments, and if you got past all the trolls, like, you could see real people commenting, and they would find what was wrong with your piece, and it just was like data. And the beautiful thing about this is that the one thing that I think Tom has excelled in his entire career is that very lesson, which is know your audience. And he and other podcasters within this realm, you know, of many different overlapping Venn diagrams, is to really, the audience is not treated like one big mass entity of eyeballs, right? The one thing I love is that you guys are real people and we know you and we talk to you and Tom and Justin and Brian and Molly and Veronica, you've all been doing that for almost a decade, you know? And so to me, that number one lesson that it took me like a year and a half to really dig into at Yahoo, know thy audience. The next job I took was with someone who really knew his.
Well, that's the one thing I can say about podcasting that I really do enjoy is that everybody is so goddamn approachable. It's not even funny. Like everybody that's, I'll put it this way, everybody that's not coming into podcasting with already a pre-existing audience from some other form of media, whether it be film or television or radio, is very approachable. It's sometimes not the flip when it's the other side. Sometimes it is, depending on who. But that's one thing I've liked. All right, now let's go to DTNS because this is
– right.
I just love – again, it's such a weird happenstance of like the same day that – okay, so – it's December. It's 2013.
Right.
2013. Right. Tom Merritt, contract ended. You lose job.
Hugged my way out of a second job.
hugged way out of second job. And now you and Tom have decided to go on this venture together.
Here's the other story that I'm certainly not supposed to tell. But this is so
Tom
amusing.
Merritt held me at gunpoint and said, if you do not do this, we have a problem.
This is a fantastic story. So I'm in the room, right? The firing room or the mutual separate, the room of surprise mutual separation where I am being mutually separated from Yahoo. And of course, like I have my instant message up and Molly and I have been known to instant message in the past. And she's like, so what's going on with you today? And I'm allowed to curse on this podcast.
Oh
right?
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Okay. So this is what I write back. I just wrote, Jesus fucking Christ, Molly, I'm being fired right now. And she wrote, write me back. So she had already left CNET, and she was just sort of floating around in her post-CNET universe. And Tom was floating around, and I was floating around. And so she introduced me to him. And from there, it was just kind of like, it was one of those things where Tom displayed such tremendous faith in me, like without like ever really... like only meeting me once, and that had everything to do with Molly just being like her and Tom being like, okay. And that leap of faith was like, when I think about it, pretty tremendous. And that just shows you, as you guys know even better than I do, what kind of a person Tom is.
Well, I would say that it's the kind of person that Tom is, but also that Molly is a very, very trusted colleague of Tom's and also, you know, a good friend of Tom's. So the point that I've noticed in the world of independent media that the more personable you are, and more importantly, the more times you get a recommendation from somebody other than, you know, somebody you trust, that it goes a long way.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there you go. So that chance meeting that I got hired for in 2010, met Molly Wood, led to basically this job that has changed my life. Wait, hold on. I'm going to cough. Wait, I'm muting. I'm pressing the cough button.
What's funny about podcasting and the way I tend to care about things, and maybe this is what I like about podcasting more than like about radio. I don't know what it is about people and the cough, like why it is everyone. Because like it's funny. When I was a kind of wee little podcaster and the early days of my kind of career, so to speak, I would always look at the what's the freaking is like things like B. I forget the broadcasting company, not B&H Photo, but like one of the people that sell like, you know, cardioid mics, right, and crazy things like that. And there's always this device that I'd see would be, you know, essentially an XLR in, XLR out, and a big giant cough button. And I go, what the hell is that? And I realized, oh, right, you don't cough on the air. And I would always be like, I should buy one of those. I need one of those. And I'm like, what the fuck do I need one of those? Why the fuck do I need a mute a cough? I'm just going to,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's just a holdover from a time when people cared about stuff like that, which is the cough button in itself is a perfect example of the difference between radio as it evolved, television as it evolved, and then this idea of, just going back to what my dad and his buddies did in the 60s, which was, I'm going to cough. I'm going to goddamn cough. I'm going to eat a bagel if I'm hungry. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And just giving us life as it is. And I think that what's so great and what people have responded to so much about podcasting is that it's just a continuation of that level of intimacy approaching real life. And I can certainly say that we've seen that in many a podcast.
You know, yeah.
In Night Attack, we saw it. We saw like an entire argument happen, unfold, and get resolved live on the air. I think that
that's
was
right. You
more,
watched it. Oh,
I it was one of the more tremendously compelling things I've ever seen, like on any medium.
It was something to be there in person for sure. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. And I came down. I finally came down on the fence because always the two sides of me are warring, right? Which is like cut and dried professional. Like that's the most atrocious thing I've ever seen. And then like the sense of real things unfolding in real time, which made it the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And two people honestly trying to figure out what the F just happened. and so, you know, I'm like losing my point, but my basic point is like, I really like podcasting.
Well,
I really like it.
Well, because it's, you know, it's funny. You talk about the whole intimacy and that. I mean, what I enjoy about podcasting versus radio, and I've listened to a lot of radio over my time, not just FM and things like that, but some NPR and stuff like that. And what I've noticed, especially when you can kind of tell when a podcaster is coming from a radio background, and they tend to do things like this. They will say their statement, pause while they think about their next words they're going to say, and then follow up with a question, and then cut to commercials. Like, it's always the same kind of thing. It's always stilted. It's always paused. There's always a measure to how they speak, mm-hmm. which nobody talks like that in real life. We all have different cadences and certain ticks and certain audio things. And what I've noticed about in podcasting is that because it's sort of this still viewed as kind of the Wild West world of content creation, people just do whatever and see what happens. And it's one of the beauty things of it being that organic.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And in some ways, it's sort of like me coming to peace with all the things I grew up with, right?
Right.
Like, I was not alive in the 60s when my dad was doing all this work, but like it was a very omnipresent legacy, to put it mildly, in a certain quarter of the Upper West Side of New York. And I sort of like fled from that level of personal, you know, like my life was discussed on the radio before I was old enough to have a say about it.
Do you have any of those like audio recordings?
Oh,
left?
Yeah, I do. Oh, there is a recording of me at 4 years old, totally blowing the call sign for WBAT because I called it there. I just did it again. It's WBAI, and I called it WBAT and announced with full confidence that it was located in Florida.
Oh,
which
my
it
God.
Certainly was not. And
that's
it's hilarious.
Amazing.
It's hilarious. So, like, you know, there's all these things where, like, I was on the radio talking about, like, how, like, trying to explain heavy metal to my dad. You know, like, there were all these, like, there's all this, like, this history of me on the radio in a very minor capacity. And then I, like, ran away from that at full speed. And now it seems in a different medium, I'm edging my way back.
Well, let's get back to talking about podcasting, things like that, especially DTNS. Okay.
Yes.
So let's, all right. You meet Tom, you both lose your jobs, you both says do DTNS. What was your game plan from that point? Like, what was going to be your role in the show? And then, I mean, obviously Tom doing the news and things like that. You had mentioned that in podcasting, you felt that you now have to do so many jobs. So how did you get inundated with that? Like, all right, Jenny, here's everything you need to do. And it's this big giant stack of papers almost.
Well, so, right. So the one thing I learned from both Bali and Tom is that they had not, per se, producers in their world were very different.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. I've never quite understood,
right.
And maybe it's because I come from the podcasting background of having to do everything, that I don't know what a producer in podcasting truly does.
You tell me. Like, you know, it took me a while to realize that when on Buzz Out Loud, because I've watched some of the old episodes, and on Twit, what producer meant was sound producer, technical producer, someone who was switching the feed, someone who's making sure the levels worked, like that, and someone who then in that capacity became a personality on the show. But, and now producer is such a generic word, like I could say movie producer, and those people have like a whole different set of responsibilities.
Yep.
And you know, a news producer on local news has different responsibilities than a network producer, right? So, you know, but my job when I worked at network was like to do research and to, and theoretically, if I had made it up the chain, to write for these incredible correspondents and to get them where they needed to go. It was sort of like the all service editorial Sherpa, because these correspondents were busy being shot out of a plane to get to somewhere to go stand in front of a building where something bad had happened. And you needed to be able to do their job while they were in transit. And that's just like one example. But, you know, the producer was as editorially responsible for the broadcast as the correspondent themselves. Now, what I learned in retrospect was that Tom and Molly and all these people, they were exactly as responsible because they were, in essence, reporters who happened to be using a different medium to tell their story. Right. So they were so used to doing it all themselves. And if they were lucky, they got a Jason Howell or they got Veronica in the beginning, like they got people to help them out. And so when I came along with Daily Tech News Show, like I looked at this show and I was like, what am I going to do? Like there's almost nothing for me to do because all of this show could be done by Tom. But then we realized, like, okay, fine, but if we take this responsibility away from him and this responsibility away, all this stuff that's just, like extra work that goes on every day, what else could he accomplish if he's not doing all of this essentially busy work?
Right.
And then, so that was the first thing. Like, so what I'll do is, like, the night before, I'll build the new rundown for the day. I'll add in all the messages. I'll add in the pick of the day. I'll add in, you know, the plugs and just all the basic mechanics of the show that make it run. And then during the day of, I'm also looking at stories. I'm submitting stuff for consideration. And then I'm sort of making sure during the show that the audio levels are okay. And so that's like the basic day to day. But then my job is also to think bigger and think, okay, we've hit $10,000 a month. What can we really do to thank people? What can we do? How can we make things happen? What is a unique way to do that? Or, for example, you know, we want to do this peering special. How can we do that? Who can we get on the show? Oh, I'm also booking guests. So like, so all of a sudden going from like a rundown that seemed like I had nothing to add. Oh, and show notes. Yep, there's that. So
essentially what you're telling me is you're doing everything short of host and analyze almost.
Right. But
And even then the analyze is like 50-50 almost.
No, certainly not. With Tom,
but not 50-50,
he is like, I think the best way to do it is that I'm doing what I've always done.
Okay.
Just support the talent, right? You've got Tom. He does a brilliant thing. You all know like what a value it is. And my job is to make that a little bit easier. That's my job. I could tell you in a sentence.
after all that time. Well, because it's – I say that because it's such a – like a producer, you know, when I hear it, you're right. I never know what that means. And almost to me, it almost sounds like, yes, you're producer in title, but you're more like second in command almost in the podcast. Like if Tom is the captain of the DTNS ship, you're definitely the Riker of the Diz Picard. Right.
I like that. I also like the analogy that I've settled on is a Sherlock Holmes and Watson analogy, right? Because it's a highly analytical, logical, brilliant person at the helm. And then you've got this sort of like pretty, you know, laid back, semi-emotional, temper tantrum-y person in second in command, which is like that's an exaggeration of what Watson is. But like Watson has
Watson's definitely more emotional.
Watson's a goader. He's a right. He goads Sherlock into, in all the incarnations, into, you know, just a little bit more. Just give us, you know, like just do this. And like, and so that would be, that's my preferred analogy, is to just like gently channel the brilliance.
So
that it has its full reach. So there you go.
Well, I find that just so awesome. We're almost out of time here. We're almost at the hour mark here. We've come to this, but as kind of your last thought is sort of this thing, because it's I find it's again just so amazing just how how you've gone from, and again, I always knew there was a story here. I just never knew that was the story, how you went from.
Well, you're the first person to ask. So there you go.
Well, because, like, again, you came from what a lot of people would consider the top and not necessarily worked your way to the bottom. For, you know, okay, I'll say this way. From a tradition, from a stupid corporate Nielsen worshiping fool, I'll say that. You don't have to say that. That's me. You went from the top to the bottom. Ugh.
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I went from, and this is a great sum up thought. I went from an atmosphere of brilliant people at CBS News, brilliant journalists, constrained by 50 years of tradition. And then I went to a company where there was less constraint, but it was maybe not the right fit for me, because in the end it really was just about selling ads to fill these pages. And that's really what most of the organized, mature internet companies.
What I always say to a lot of people off the cuff, and I've said, and it's sort of a saying I've had in my head, if there are ads being presented, chances are the content is not the product.
Yep. And so what I ended up with, Daily Tech News Show in its fledgling almost 6-month nascent form, is what I think a lot of people that I used to work with at these other companies would kill to have, which is a space to be authentic, a space to tell stories and to inform people about what's going on in the news of the day as we see it, and a chance to sort of experiment and see how the format can evolve. And a chance not to have to have it paid by ads, because there is this incredibly loyal audience who we didn't even get a chance to talk about, supporting that effort. And so it, to me, my entire journey so far has been a journey from not the top to the bottom, but the constrained format to free form.
And that's what I love. That's the best way to put it, because it's such a hard thing to express to people as to how important the audience is. And it's something that when Tom did the whole Patreon thing, that one, I said it was brilliant in my head. And two, I am so glad. I am so glad as both a listener, a fan, and I guess, you know, as a fellow podcaster of, you know, to Tom's, I am so glad it went it's gone as far as it has and is continuing to go further.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And it really is thanks to a tremendously loyal group of people who have put their coin, you know, against something that is not tangible. That they don't get, you know, they don't get a t-shirt out of it. They don't get a book. They get information, and they find that information is delivered by Tom valuable enough to pay $1 or $5. And to me, having come from the womb of public radio, it is amazing to me that people, it has never ceases to amaze me that people will pay for something they could otherwise get for free. And that is the magic of an authentic connection between a host and his audience. And I'm lucky.
As a fun note, because of that, Tom gets paid more than what ads would ever pay him. I won't go into CPMs and things like that, but I want you people to understand that what Tom's getting paid per episode, thanks to you guys, is, and you too, Jenny, for that matter, is way more than an advertiser would ever pay.
And without a whole – and granted, like, we're never ruling out that a time may come when we may need to do things that are advertising sponsored. So I'm not going to sit here and be like,
No. I don't want to come off as saying that ads are bad or anything like that. There's, you know, I've had Tom on before. It's always give and take when it comes to ads and things like that. I just have – I'm of a kind of a belief right now, and this is sort of where I stand on it, and I may be the crazy guy saying this, but I know sometime in the not so distant future, when a lot of the networks get really wise to the internet, and I mean really wise, not this sort of like, oh, we've got our little test tube thing, or oh, we've got CBS Interactive, but those are all separate ventures. Once they become wise to what the internet is and what the potential is, we're going to start to see an influx of the shows that tend to bring that are tend to be a little bit cheaper on the cost, but tend to bring in more of the audience. Things like, you know, what is it, like the America's Got Talent, or what's that freaking singing one? The other
American Idol.
American Idol. You know, we're going to see a lot of those shows come online, and I hate to say it, but those have a lot of eyeballs already attached to them who will probably watch it online and probably still consume it in a way that they think is the same. But because of that, a lot of those ad dollars that would go to smaller little, you know, micro things would probably be better spent over in those bigger things. And so I have a feeling that sometime in the not-so-distant future, we're going to have this weird shift of things. Mm-hmm. And the people who are not connected to their audience, who do not acknowledge them and thank them for everything that they're worth, are the ones that are going to, you know, falter in this sort of shift. And what I love about Tom and you and sort of the podcast that I tend to, you know, both look up to and want to be like and enjoy are the ones that do that, that really love their audience. And it shows in things like, you know, you guys were pretty much the people that invented the Thankpocalypse concept in Patreon. And it's become the thing that every Patreon person is now doing, including me.
Do they
me.
Do that? I didn't know that.
I'm planning on doing my Patreon whenever I get to a certain goal level, because it's such a – it's such an awesome concept of just saying, you know what, you guys have brought us here. We can't and you can't thank people enough for that. And it's such a rewarding thing, because I had known it was going on. And then somehow I got a pop up in the chat room saying, you know, my hand, like, what's this for? Oh, I guess I said something about me. And I'm like, where is it in the timeline? Because I want to hear it, because it's such a rewarding thing. I mean, it was like, how many hours was it?
Oh, gosh, it was 4.5 hours.
Like four and a half hours of just simply saying a name and a little anecdote, you know, whatever. Let me put it this way. If it had been normal television, that would never have happened. If it had been normal radio, that would never have happened. But because it's this sort of connection in internet land, for some bizarre reason, this sort of thing that's supposed to, you know, be zeros and ones and very cold and callous just because of the nature of digital sometimes, was like the most human thing ever. And it was probably the best moment in podcasting just smiling, because it's something that you could only do in online media.
Yep, in online media. And that to me was worth every step of the journey that brought me to this job, because I saw what was possible, which is in essence anything. And, you know, it's funny because, like, again, we're talking about moving from a place where you didn't know your audience at all at CBS. You were like, well, sometimes they write us letters and sometimes they call and they're pretty pissed off, to understanding audience behavior on the internet at Yahoo, but not really knowing your audience until I got to the Daily Tech News Show. And I sometimes go on the Patreon and I look and I make it a point to, like, look at everybody's picture or look at their name or look at where they're from and realize, like, these aren't letter writers or phone callers and they're not tracking pixels.
These aren't a demographic.
These aren't a demographic. These are people.
Yep.
And they gave us a dollar. And that to me is amazing. And I just can't think of any better place to be and anyone better to be working with than someone that really has understood that for upcoming decade.
No, it is totally awesome. We are out of time. Jenny, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people they can find you online beyond your work of Daily Tech News Show and things like that.
I am JennyJ23. So JennyJ23 on Twitter. And I have an about me page. It's like about.me/JennyJ. So those are like the two best places to find me. I often write on medium.com when the moment seizes. Usually it's a restaurant review or a travel thing or just something I thought of and was like, I got to put this down. So, yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 on the Twitters. You want to talk about your experience with podcasting? Maybe you have a favorite story you'd like to tell. Go to our website, cosmere.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to the show notes, previous episodes. The Patreon for this show, if you want to show your support for here, is also linked there as well. And, of course, all the other shows in the network, such as my gaming podcast, Jump Point, that I do with Mr. Bryce Castillo. So that's it for today. So tune in next time when I talk to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people.
Bye.
Like I said at the top of the show, we're trying something new, and I kind of want to give a final thought on this whole episode. I always knew that there was a story behind Jenny. When I met her at South By and Tom introduced her and things like that, I always knew there had to be some type of story behind her and Tom kind of hooking up in terms of production style. Because when Tom went independent, I said in the past, I thought he would just never do this again. And knowing that there's a story there sometimes doesn't always mean there is a story. But having that kind of inclination always helps. What I loved about this episode was that not only, A, did I kind of know there's a story there, I didn't expect the story to be that insane. I didn't expect it to be going from CBS network style all the way to what people would consider the quote-unquote dregs of podcasting. I jokingly say that because honestly, I do believe podcasting and the internet's a lot better in terms of personality and in terms of personal, I guess, nature than the networks are. They have networks to me always feel cold and calculated and planned, whereas podcasting always felt human and real to me. And what I liked about hearing Jenny's story is that her kind of meandering through all these different production types and figuring out what that is allowed her to find where she needed to be, where she essentially exactly belongs. And it was so great to talk with her and kind of learn that story. And I hope you all enjoyed it. In fact, if you guys did, it's kind of a little bit of a weird call to action. Normally, at this kind of level of show, I really would ignore this and sort of this. But I kind of want to, I've been doing this about 120 some odd episodes now. And I really, really want to grow this audience. So the best way I think to do that is actually have you guys kind of promote it. One, because A, you are probably more valuable to me than any amount of advertisers I could ever get. You guys are, in fact, my most valuable resource and will always be my most valuable resource. And I know you know people that would love the show and would love to hear this episode or would rather hear another episode. Or you know of some community out there that would love to hear about this one episode or this other episode or something else. I know you know that because of who I happen to have. I've had so many guests over the years that I know that there is that one magical episode that, I really think this forum over here would like it. Or, I really think this subreddit would like it. Or I really think this dig community would like it. Or, the guys over at Slashdot might like it. Or, holy crap, Kotaku, why didn't you see this? I know that those areas on the web exist. And I know that if you guys just simply, tweet it out or post it there or whatever, I know that they'll respond more to you because you're part of that community and you are a vital organism in there and you're personal there. And so my call to action for you guys this episode is sort of a new thing. Share this with people you know would like it, or share it with a community you know you'd like it, just so that we can get the word out. I'm not asking you guys to promote something that you didn't enjoy. If you enjoyed this episode, share it. If you didn't, then that's fair. Leave a comment. Let me know what you didn't like. I'd love to know what people hate and what people love. I'm okay with criticism. But please, if you enjoyed this site, if it makes it easier, just give them the link to the actual URL, mysocialabitlife.com. If that's an easier way for you to point directly to it, figure it out. I'm okay either way. But please, please, please let people know you enjoyed the show. Let it know over Twitter or Facebook, any other of your social networks. Heck, if you're on that weird little network, heck, if you have friends online over in Japan, let them know too if you think they enjoy the show. Guys, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you had a fun, fun time.
I'll give you a simple one.
Okay.
Which is, I sometimes build the Daily Tech News Show rundown the night before. So I have been known, before I literally set like a bear trap alarm on this, to write the day before into the rundown. And then, so say like it's Tuesday, May. Whoa. What's
Oh, fun times, people, because I have to know. Daryl, when you get this note, feel free to edit this. But if you want to be funny, put this at the end of the podcast.
Okay, so there's like a parking situation and dogs. Can we start like again?
Yeah, of course we can.
5 minutes. Hold on.
Go for it.
Oh my God. Hold on.
No problem. That's awesome. This is podcasting 101. We're like 105.9 the cat. Am I right?
Okay, hi, I'm back. Let's do that again.
Let's just edit point.
Yeah, edit point.